Paper 11, section 9, last section, which is old single column, page 126. Okay, I guess the preface will do. Just beforehand, Gene was asking, and I think I may not have gotten to actually commenting on it. So, and it's worth commenting on. The right at the very end of that previous paragraph of section 8, we got into talking about the, you know, kind of really the advanced elements that are in that, about the eternity viewpoint on the differential between the three reservoirs of potential, you know, and looking at that differently than the time viewpoint. But that last little bit there, you know, after they say the illustration is crude but nonetheless helpful. So again, I don't want to go back and read the whole thing, but just remember there's this idea of thinking of gravity in tension terms. You know, using the note, in other words, generalizing the way you're going to think about gravity and allowing the analogy of tension to help you think about it, if that's helpful in a particular circumstance. And, you know, so as I said, you know, it might be helpful, you know, but always keep in mind it's a bit of a crude analogy. But the one thing especially, okay, when it says there at the end, it also explains why gravity always acts preferentially in the plane perpendicular to the mass, a phenomenon indicative of the differential dimensions of paradise and the surrounding creations. Okay, the picture they're invoking there is pervaded space. So, you know, when you have this, some analogy of the aisle and its relationship to space, and you have this elliptical pancake that is the aisle, and that somewhere in that picture that you're using to try to understand the geometry of things, and you know, in extending out, then in those geometrical analogies, parallel with that plane of that pancake of the aisle, is this central plane of pervaded space, you know, heading all the way out through all the outer space levels, all the way out to the edge of the master universe. And now, you know, there's pervaded space is not just a thin slab like that plane that you're picturing there. It's, you know, it extends, you know, especially as you get out of ways, I mean, it goes practically vertical. I mean, it's, you know, massive vertical extent on the distribution of galaxies above and below that plane as you get out into the second outer space level, and of course even more if there were galaxies out beyond that. But the thing that you notice out there, even when there's all of this vertical extent above and below that plane of extension of the plane of the aisle, is that the galaxies aren't sort of uniformly distributed all throughout that volume. There's more of them closer to the plane. Okay. So there's the center of mass. You know, if you go out anywhere out in that plane and you think about the vertical distribution, there's a center to that distribution. It's not uniformly distributed. There's a definite a concentration of mass, you know, around that plane. So there's, you know, the mass, you know, the center of mass is really in that plane. Okay, so you notice that something is tending to keep these things from just drifting away from the plane. There's some sort of, like, tension. Like, all the galaxies have, you know, gentle elastic bands attached to them that are kind of gently pulling them back towards that plane. Okay. That's what they're alluding to here, this preferentially in the plane perpendicular to the plane of the mass. Okay, there's obviously something that's tending to draw things together there. Okay, and if you, you know, if you, you envision that there's some kind of a presence that that the aisle has throughout all of space, in this case through the dark gravity bodies, an influence that it's imposing, and we call that physical gravity, and they're saying there's a, you know, it's valid to understand some of the higher aspects of that fact of physical gravity with the notion of tension. Well, you can just say, okay, so in other words, there's this tension that's present, and this tension is tending to, you know, it's sort of an extension of the aisle, this tension. The aisle is not spherical. The aisle is pancake-like. So as in the center, so away from the center. They're just saying, I mean, they're thinking of this gravity presence as being a tension presence that is modeled after the geometry of the aisle. So since it's not spherical, it's going to have a tendency to impose a tension presence on the distribution of galaxies, making them come closer to the, you know, to the center. And then the other thing that we had along that line, if you recall back when we were reading about Nether Paradise, you could also say, well, what about, you know, the whole plane kind of drifting away from being sort of a direct extension of the aisle? And remember, there was they said that through the dark gravity bodies, there can be an east-west differential, one way or the other, that is tending to keep that plane of the mass, you know, actually located directly horizontally outward, you know, in other words, centered in the volume of pervaded space and not drifting up and down in the volume of pervaded space. So you have that influence of the east-west presence of the aisle that's keeping it, you know, actually located centrally, vertically in pervaded space. And then you have this crude idea of a tension presence that's trying to mold the distribution after the shape of the aisle, quote unquote. Okay, so that's what they're alluding to there. So,
the plane is where most of them are focused. Can you think of above the plane as up and below the plane as down?
Yeah, I mean, certainly.
So does that mean that the gravity, the galaxies below the plane are being pulled up?
Yeah, and you know, obviously this influence has this tendency, see, for things below to be drawn up some and things above to be drawn down some. You know, it's the fact that, you know, if, you know, you'd go, okay, so if the aisle was a sphere, certainly there would be nothing that would lead you to suspect that the presence, this gravity presence that's modeled then after the aisle would do anything except what you see normal linear gravity doing. You know, you have a sphere of mass and, you know, things are just drawn radially inward in every direction. Okay. But they're saying this transcendent gravity presence is modeled after something that's not spherical. So it has a differential. It's almost like you have a gravity presence that isn't, you know, radially inward, but is just vertical. It's still inward toward the plane. Okay. So that's what they're getting at. And I mean, you can tell by the way they say that they don't really in any very direct way even understand paradise gravity and how it's channeled through the dark gravity bodies and how it's that presence then manifests. I mean, they have basically just an empirical, you know, a phenomenological understanding. They've watched it carefully. They know the details of it, but causally, they're still a little bit vague on it themselves. Right, so it's just an attraction principle, but it has this modification from what we're used to with the gravity-like attraction, that it isn't spherical. It's obviously, there's something that is tending to be drawing things towards a plane. Okay. You know, yep.
So, paralyzed gravity is what keeps the whole universe not falling apart.
It keeps it in an overall structure.
Okay. When they say gravity for us, like they say gravity pulls you down, mm-hmm. you know, like you get older and you go straight. Right. How does that, the paradise gravity and the gravity that we're feeling, because mm-hmm. I mean, you think of paradise is up here, and then you think of us as down here, but then it would be drawing you up if we were getting it from paradise gravity. So how does that
right,
work?
Right, right. Okay, so just, yeah, one little quick reminder again on that. So, two things about paradise gravity. You have paradise gravity through the dark gravity bodies, which just sort of establishes the form, you know, the structure, the overall structure of the master universe, gives it all of this geometry of pervaded and unpervaded, you know, and all of this structure that's imposed by the aisle, and the flows in that structure are imposed by the aisle. For you, you know, and the matter in you, paradise gravity doesn't act on you in any sort of, you know, pulling you one way or another. What paradise gravity does to influence you is it's the centering influence for every automaton in every particle in your body. It's keeping all of the little particles that are combined together to build your body, it's keeping them all particleized. It's keeping them all wrapped around a center point. Keeping them as integrous spheres of energy. Not letting them, you know, just go every which direction. It's keeping it all wrapped back on itself as this little ball of energy, ball of motion. And then, so that's the absolute gravity that you're benefiting from. It's giving you an ongoing integrity. All the particles in your body don't unravel because of the influence of the aisle. And then this secondary effect, this relative effect, relative gravity, this linear gravity, that's what you feel in the macroscopic sense of, you know, pulling you to the ground or dragging your cheeks down when you get old or whatever, okay? And even literally dragging your consciousness down, okay? Your mind is material, okay? You have a very material mind. Agitated mind is very material-like energy. Material gravity literally affects agitated mind. It's tending to draw your consciousness down. You have to choose to identify with spirit gravity and have your consciousness lifted up. If you don't want to be limited by the, you know, the inadequacies of your genetic foundation, you need to choose to identify with spirit energy so that spirit gravity can lift you up. Otherwise, material gravity, I mean, you don't have any choice in that. It just will pull you down. You know, you get depressed. Yeah, you get depressed if you've forgotten about that and you've just let material gravity drag you down into the hollow of your mind. You're depressed. You're literally, yeah. It works exactly like why your feet stay on the ground. Okay, material gravity will just drag your consciousness down into the bowels of your mind. Okay. Okay, Jason.
Well, I was going to say we have cultural inadequacies too.
Right, sure. I mean, you know, if you don't want to be a helpless victim of antecedent causation, be it just literally material gravity, or you know, this sort of relative mindal gravity of thoughts out there. I mean, you know, notice that thoughts are compelling. You're drawn towards thoughts. You know, just like you're drawn towards unity, See, there's a mindal gravity and a spiritual gravity too, on a relative basis, just like there is on the absolute. Okay, so you have to monitor that. It's like, well, wait a minute. Have I done an assessment on this thought that I'm being drawn towards? I mean, you will, you know, if it's well constructed, you'll be drawn toward it. You should maybe think about whether or not it's something that you should allow yourself to be drawn towards. You know, if you don't think about it, if it's cleverly crafted, you will just naturally be drawn toward it, just like you're naturally drawn towards the floor. And the next thing you know, you've come right up, you know, and you have totally taken on that thought that someone, you know, was very clever, you know, in constructing. You know, and if it's very, very clever, it's not just mindal, it's spiritual. And what do we call something, you know, that has this spiritual drawing power to it, but inside it's hollow? It's a sophistry, right? See, sophistry works because of there's a relative spirit gravity as well. You know, and if you aren't in charge of this, you'll just find yourself drawn to it. But you've got to think, right? It's spirit candy, right? You've got to think about, you got to use your insight to see if you should really allow yourself to be drawn to that, or if you need to say, no, I'm not going to put that first. I'm going to put God first. If I'm going to feel spirit gravity, I want it to be from God, not from that, because that's hollow.
Very good. Wow, yeah.
Okay? Okay. And you'll see, you know, we get into that, you know, in the next paper. They start talking about physical, mindful, and spiritual gravity. Just always remember, you know, they'll introduce it on an absolute basis, but they always have a relative expression.
Perpendicular to the mass is...
So, most of the mass is in this plane of the first outer space level, the second outer space level. There's more galaxies in that plane than there is above and below that plane. Okay, you know, if you map the locations of the galaxies all around us, they aren't just uniformly distributed all around us. There's more of them closer to a plane than there is above and below. Okay, so they're, you know, that's right, they shade off in either direction. Yeah. Okay. So in the midst of all of that complexity of matter and all of this different relative and you know, quasi-absolute because it's through the dark gravity bodies, presence of the eye, all this stuff, I mean, and all this complication with matter. At the center of all that is the uniqueness of the aisle, the uniqueness of paradise, this last section here in this paper. So let's just see how they wrap up for us this issue of what the aisle represents to the big picture.
Section 9, the uniqueness of paradise. Paradise is unique in that it is the realm of primal origin and the final goal of destiny for all spirit personalities. Although it is true that not all of the lower spirit beings of the local universes are immediately destined to paradise, paradise still remains the goal of desire for all supermaterial personalities. Paradise is the geographic center of infinity. It is not a part of universal creation, not even a real part of the eternal Havona universe. We commonly refer to the central aisle as belonging to the divine universe, but it really does not. Paradise is an eternal and exclusive existence.
Okay, so let's try to really remember that paragraph. It's not really well remembered by many longtime readers. Okay? So, you know, make a break. you know, get that really clear that, like they're saying, they may often refer to the aisle as being part of the central universe, you know, or at the center of the central universe, but it's not literally so. There is a point of symmetry at the center of the central universe. It's not like the circuits of the central universe are not circuits. It's not like they don't go around, okay? I mean, there's definitely a center of symmetry. It isn't just a bunch of straight lines that the worlds are on heading off to infinity. You know, they go around. So there's definitely a centering influence presence of the aisle in a macroscopic sense. But the aisle itself is not literally there. It's not literally at the center of the central universe. It's not literally at the center of the grand universe. It's not literally at the center of the master universe. It's only literally at the center of the cosmos infinite. Because, see, paradise is the geographic center of infinity. Not at the central universe. It's the geographic center of infinity, the totality of reality. So in terms of that totality of reality made cosmos, made places that you could travel amongst, the cosmos infinite, that cosmos infinite has a geometry, it has a geographic character, okay? And there's, in that cosmos infinite, there's a center to that geography, and the aisle is literally there. Okay, it literally is there, you know, basically at the infinite level. The aisle is literally there. But if you drop down below that to, you know, the very sub-infinite master universe, the aisle isn't literally there. Yeah. The definitely sub-infinite central universe, the aisle is not there either. Okay. So, yeah, it's just take it literally, as they say, it's the geographic center of infinity, the totality of reality, not some part of reality, the totality of reality. Yep.
Infinity is non-ending in all directions.
Right, but here, this word infinity, as it's used in the Urantia book here, is short for the totality of reality. If you have, in paper 105, where you're trying to think of everything all balled together in one concept called the I Am, the first thing you do is you say, well, let's take this concept of the I Am and let's conceptually split it into two parts, deity and reality. Okay. And, you know, we're talking about an infinite concept, the infinite concept of the I Am. So if I split that infinite concept up into two parts, the reality part, the totality of that reality part is going to be quite big. we need a big word to describe it. That word is infinity. Lowercase I infinity is the word that literally means the totality of that infinite reality that you are imagining unpacking out of this conceptual suitcase of the I Am. I'm taking all the reality, unpacking it, putting it over here. I call it infinity, lowercase I. And I take all the deity, and I put it over here. And now the suitcase is empty. Okay, the concept of the I Am has served its initial purpose of being, you know, the bottle in which I had everything packed. And I'm gonna very methodically, in some sort of a logical order, unpack that, and so I can understand what was in that infinite suitcase. Okay, so that's what the word infinity means, lowercase I, the totality of reality. So it's not a word that just means the extension of distance. Okay, it's talking about reality. It's talking about all the literalness of everything. At the center of the literalness of everything. Okay? Not just the vacuum extension, you know, like that. Okay. So not just a mathematical infinity, yeah, but a literal substantive infinity.
So if on the finite and the absentite level, paradise isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
what is at the center in the finite and the absolute?
A center of symmetry. I mean, you know, the
a point.
It's just a point about which everything is centered.
The seven super universes.
Everything. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously a special point. You know, and there's nothing inside that makes it special. In order for something to take the whole master universe and make the whole of it somehow dance about a point, that something has to be transcendent of everything. It has to somehow be able to order everything about around, literally around a point. It has to say, of all the points in the master universe, this point is special. And all the mass in the master universe says, well, why is that point special? Why not? Because I said so. This point is special. This is the point about which you are all going to move. Yes, sir, says all the automatons, and they do. Okay? It orders the whole master universe to go about a center of symmetry. All the patterns that it takes on all have a center of symmetry.
Could it be like a reflection of it?
Right. See, so it's on the outside, but it reflects itself out through that central point. Wow. It's like it's inverted out, you know, through that point. Not only on the macroscopic like that, but then every single point also is a little flower point as well. Okay.
Would anybody see on the absonite or the finite level the dark gravity bodies?
Sure. Yeah, the dark gravity bodies are bonk, you know. Everyone plows their head into those, yeah.
So they'll hit the gravity bodies before they hit this center of...
That's why you need a really good pilot, okay? Because those things, you know, even the lowliest finite thing will slam smack into those and be obliterated, okay? So, okay, you need someone who can get you through the... You know, the turmoil of those, of that, without, you know, wrecking the ship on the rocks.
So that'll be the adjuster or the seraphim?
Yeah, what kind is it? Who remembers?
Supernafim?
Yeah. That.
Seconafim.
Right? Remember, the seconafim are taking you in. A seraphim will take you back out again. Okay. Okay. All right.
Is the creation of the combination of our thought adjuster and our personality a new thing that wasn't in the IM to begin with?
No. See, that's all, everything is in the IM.
So each of us as we are now could say that this combination of my thought adjuster and my personality existed in the IM.
Yeah, I mean, the creating you is always in the sense of out of the suitcase of the I am, you unpack reservoirs of potential. One of those reservoirs of potential you pulled out of there is the infinite one, the first source. Okay? And you ladle, you know, individuations out of that called personality. Okay? So that personality didn't, you know, it's all in there in that reservoir, and it's just individuated out of it and bestowed upon each of us. Same way with the thought adjuster. There's one of the big reservoirs you pull out of the suitcase is the infinite upholder.
In combination, they didn't exist in the...
No. Okay. That's the whole point about the concept of the I am and why it's inadequate. It's because, yeah, it's infinite, but it's singular. Everything is all mixed together. You know, I need an adjuster and a personality, not a adjuster a la leader. I have to somehow have two separate things. Something has to make two separate reservoirs so that I can individuate two separate things out of it. I don't have all of matter, mind, spirit, deity, you know, everything all balled up in one homogeneous glob.
And thereby manifest the individual that will result from the combination of those two.
Right, because you have all of these differentials then. I mean, the differential between an adjuster and a personality. You know, the differential between an adjuster and an automaton, and an Andromeda galaxy. And I mean, all of these create all of this potential, all of these relationships out of that differential. What?
Along with free will.
Right. I mean, that's the fascinating thing about the stuff, if you will, that's in that reservoir called the first source. It's a very fancy stuff. It has one of its attributes is a thing we call free will. It's just one of its properties. Just like, you know, energy has certain properties. When you pull it out of that reservoir of the unqualified absolute and, you know, actualize it out here, it has certain properties. If you actualize the potential in the first source, what you actualize has certain properties. One of them is called free will, you know, etc.
So he lets us personalities go out there, and we're a part of him, and he's got his automatons in us, that he gives us free rein to screw everything up.
Not everything, just yourself.
Just ourselves. And other people.
Well, yeah, but not permanently.
You could screw somebody else.
Well, you can relatively, but not absolutely, see. You know, any influence I have on you is only relative. You have, the Father has given you the ability to overrule anything I can do to you. He's given you the ability to overrule anything an Ancient of Days can do to you. He's given you absolute free will about you and your relationship to eternity. So that, you know, nothing, no one can trump me on that. I'm in absolute control of my relationship to eternity. My relationship to that doorway? No. Everything can intervene and, you know, mess up my grand plan for going between point A and point B and going through that doorway. You know, a tree could fall on me halfway there. You know, I mean, you name it. All kinds of things can intervene with my plans, the best made plans of mice and men, because those are relative. Those are not absolute.
Yeah. Chris, you can continue to fail, or by then you'll have faith to live by.
Well, I mean, you always have faith, but it, you know, you want to grow that faith into trust, and you do that when you really have positive feedback that faith isn't just wishful thinking. If you turn that very shadowy, intangible, mere faith, spiritual faith, into a substance called your soul, okay? And that's not so shadowy and fuzzy anymore. It's not just your wishful thinking. You can feel it. It's solid. You've grown faith into trust. You've taken spiritual faith and made it soul trust. You've turned the tenuous into the substantive, into the solid, okay? And no longer are you batted about. Because now to move you, they don't just have to go, you know, and blow the fuzzy spirit about, you know, and you go drifting with it. Okay. To move you, they've got to move your soul. Well, the soul is wrapped around the adjuster. And the adjuster's connected high up. Okay, a little hard to move the adjuster. You're not going to be moved. No one's going to blow your soul about like they can blow your tenuous, grasping faith about. Now, living faith, trust, is unshakable, inconcussable, you know, as they like to say. Okay? All right. No earthquake can befall it. All right.
In the eternity of the past, when the Universal Father gave infinite personality expression of his spirit self in the being of the Eternal Son, simultaneously he revealed the infinity potential of his non-personal self as paradise. Non-personal and non-spiritual paradise appears to have been the inevitable repercussion to the Father's will and act which eternalized the original Son. Thus did the Father project reality in two actual phases, the personal and the non-personal, the spiritual and the non-spiritual. The tension between them, in the face of will to action by the Father and the Son, gave existence to the conjoint actor in the central universe of material worlds and spiritual beings. When reality is differentiated into the personal and the non-personal, eternal sun and paradise, it is hardly proper to call that which is non-personal deity unless somehow qualified. The energy and material repercussions of the acts of deity could hardly be called deity. Deity may cause much that is not deity, and paradise is not deity. Neither is it conscious as mortal man could ever possibly understand such a term.
Okay, so just a couple things. If they aren't clear, let's make sure they are. You know, as you leave those two paragraphs behind, you're going to understand everything that follows in the book, knowing that one of the fundamental patterns in reality is this fundamental parallel structure. The non-personal and the personal, the controller and the creator, the material and the spiritual. Okay? Very, very fundamental, definitive pattern that gets manifest all over the place. So never lose sight of that. It's that fundamental parallelism, and it has no vertical bias to it. Okay? The personal and the non-personal are not vertically related. They're horizontally related. Yeah. Obviously, if you're talking about issues of your relationship with the Universal Father, you're focusing on your spiritual, personal aspect. But that doesn't mean that your non-personal is inferior. It's just not what you're talking about at the moment. Okay? The Isle and the Eternal Sun, like they're saying here, are on equal footing. No one is more absolute than the other one. They're equally absolute. There's two substances. Not a higher substance and a lower substance. Two horizontally, related equal substances. Spirit substance and material substance. Okay, so that, make sure that, that old notion of putting spirit above, when you're thinking about the big picture, that fades away. There's the aisle, and the sun are on equal footing on the absolute level. And and then this whole bit about deity. Okay, when we were like, and you're bringing up the I am, and that whole bit of unpacking. Here's all the deity and here's all the reality. The two don't just go off their separate ways. All of that non-deity gets patterned by deity. So you start with infinity, just this notion of the totality of reality. So here's infinity, and as you watch that go forward in your sequence of understanding, more and more that big blob of reality takes on pattern, because that pattern is being imposed upon it. And like they're pointing out, it starts with the central universe. So you have reality and you have deity. And you bring the two together in this eternal creation called the central universe. There's reality with deity pattern imposed upon it. Because deity pattern has been imposed upon that measure of the infinity, that measure of reality, the central universe has all kinds of form to it. It isn't just an amorphous cloud of matter. It isn't just a random chaos of, spheres flying about. It has all of this precise pattern. It has 10 circuits, for instance, of worlds. Okay? If there's 10 circuits of worlds, that's because Okay, so that reality has taken on that pattern. That means it's because deity imposed that pattern on it. In other words, there's a facet of deity tied to each circuit. That's where pattern comes from. Deity imposed upon reality. See, so those sorts of basic understandings are what allow you to begin to further unpack the revelation, begin to understand, for instance, why the central universe? Why does it have this, if you know why it has 10 circuits, what are the 10 facets of deity that are behind those 10 circuits? That immediately allows you to understand a whole bunch of things about the relationships between those circuits and what results from that. And why is that important? Because the aisle is the pattern of infinity. And the central universe is the pattern universe. The universe in which you live is evolutionarily, over time, taking on the pattern of the pattern universe. Every day, in every way, what's out here looks more and more like what's in there. It's the pattern universe. Everything out here is slowly being directed to take on the pattern made manifest, which is the central universe. So the more you understand about why the central universe is the way it is, the more you can understand why what you experience out here is the way it is. Why, physical things have the different patterns that they have out here. Why life has the patterns that it has out here, etc. So you're slowly trying to bring your understanding down from the pattern of infinity, the aisle, to the central universe, and then out to here and into your day-to-day life understanding. Not just because you want to do physics out here, but you want to understand yourself. And we've talked about this, that the more you can understand deity, that patterning, that source of patterning upon reality, the more you can understand why you are the way you are. You have different aspects to your character because this aspect stems from that facet of deity and this aspect stems from that facet of deity, just like this circuit in Avona stems from that facet of deity and this circuit in Avona stems from that facet of deity, etc. You get the reality and the deity connected together in an understanding, so you know your source and hence you know yourself. The old Greek, know thyself. Well, to know yourself, you need to know your source. That's the only way you can know yourself. You got to start at the source. You got to start at deity. You can't start at yourself and then make deity in your image. Okay? You start at deity and figure out why you're made the way you are because you're made in its image.
Why do you start with Avona rather than paradise? I mean, as far as... is paradise patterned by deity?
The reason is what I was saying. If I could see the cosmos infinite, and I was trying to understand all the patterns in it, I'd start at the center of that structure, the aisle. But I'm trying to understand the finite cosmos. The aisle is not literally at the center of that. It's not the immediate pattern for the finite domain. The central universe is. The aisle's pattern has been downstepped into the central universe, and that is directly expressed out in the superuniverses. In the same way, I can't understand all of the geometry of the master universe directly from the aisle, because it's not a direct expression of the aisle. That's downstepped into the dark gravity bodies, and then that's directly expressed upon the master universe. Okay? So... so that's fundamentally why. All right, so let's see. Remember that last little comment. Neither is it conscious as mortal man could ever possibly understand such a term. You just notice the way they say that, okay? I mean, how fuzzy that purposely is. It's just like we've talked about. I mean, you have to remind yourself that the aisle is this singular fact of completely transcendent energy expression. Like I was saying last time, I mean, if you could actually see the aisle, you know, a portion of the aisle in front of you, it would seem so living to you. It would seem so purposed, so glorious, so, you know, so dynamic. You say, well, okay, that has to be living, and it has to be conscious, and it has to be, you know, but, okay, yeah, you have to remind yourself, but I know it actually isn't. I know it isn't spirit. I know it isn't a person. It is just the most amazingly transcendent, purposed energy that ever could be. So high is its purpose that its pattern transcends any personality we've ever experienced. So from our limited point of view, we would call it personal, because we don't know any other word for something that's that cool. You know. Okay. And like they say, even high beings, when they go there, you know, they look at the sun and they look at the aisle. It's like, well, okay, I technically understand the difference, but they're equally cool. Okay. This expression of pure unity and its purposing that it manifests, and this expression of pure individuality and the purposing that it manifests, they are so equal in beauty that I really don't see why we use different words for them. Okay. Remember that difference between the substance is a difference in name only, you know, really to them. I mean, because they're just, like I said, it's not like this. They're on the same plane of coolness, of majesty, of beauty, of, you know, of every word you can think of like that. All right, so now then this next little, notice this tiny little paragraph set apart by big things. This is an important little paragraph.
Paradise is not ancestral to any being or living entity. It is not a creator. Personality and mind-spirit relationships are transmissible, but pattern is not. Patterns are never reflections. They are duplications, reproductions. Paradise is the absolute of patterns. Avona is an exhibit of these potentials and actuality.
Okay, it is not a creator. It is a
controller.
Okay.
I was wrong when I said it was a reflection.
It depends on how you use that word reflection. The spirit of this reflections here is in the spirit of the word transmissible. Okay, in that I can procreate offspring. I'm a person. When I procreate, my children are also persons. This potential to be personal was transmitted through my procreative act. See, personality is transmissible. Okay, I didn't literally give my child its personality. The father did. But he gave me a nature that it's not a creator nature, but it is a procreator nature. It's a nature that allows me to just do what comes naturally and give rise to an offspring that is like me. I've transmitted that potential of personalizability. You know, if I'm not a person, if I'm subhuman, I can't give rise to a human. Subhumans can't make humans. Okay. So transmissible. Before we do that, let's just make sure we the little bit about the difference between personality and pattern that they're kind of bringing up in the latter part of that little paragraph. So this whole idea of I procreate a child and that child begins to manifest personality after age six, and et cetera. And so this got transmitted from me to my children. That's not the way it works with oxygen atoms. Okay? Oxygen atoms aren't transmitting that patterning, that purposing, one to another. Okay? That purposing is just being separately imposed upon, and it's identical. Every oxygen atom is identical. No personality is the same. Okay? So notice the kind of reciprocal character of the two. I can transmit this personalizability, as it were, but the two persons are absolutely distinct. I can't transmit from one glob of energy to the next, the purposing of oxygenness. But when they do manifest purposing as power, they're identical. They're kind of reciprocals. Energy pattern and spirit pattern. Personality and, we just call it pattern. Energy pattern is pattern. The purposing of the aisle is energy pattern, or just pattern for short. My purposing, as a being, is spirit pattern, personality for short.
So one big mystery to me has always been a being that can reproduce itself without a base.
Remember, the whole point of coming down is to have a more and more definitive expression of individuality. When you go to more primitive animals, some of them are so primitive that the two sexes aren't separated yet. Okay, they're still mixed together. And so, it's self-reproducing like that. It doesn't, you don't have the two halves of the equation haven't been literally separated so that they have to then find each other and get together again. So it's just a matter of, all of the animals are mile markers along the process of completing this expression of individuation of, because it's all about relationship. You're trying to take the notion of the I am, where everything's all balled together and you're trying to get everything separated apart. So the farther you get away from that initial concept, the more definitively individuated it's going to get. If you look at the fullness of the expression of the individuality of material beings like us, that's a material son and a material daughter. There's very little blurring between the male and the female. They're very definitively expressed. You back up a little bit where it's not to that complete, perfect expression of individuation. You back up into us from them. And there's a little bit of blurring. We're not as definitively individuated. Males and females, kind of blur a little bit together. They don't blur in a material son and material daughter. They're very definitively, fully individuated, so that the full potential of the differential is in play. Only part of it is in play with us because we overlap a little bit.
Does that mean that as we mature, as beings, once we fuse, et cetera, we will become more...
Yeah, when you think about going towards light and life, the extent to which some of our blurring, is due to the lack of Adamic uplift, that will begin to fade away once we make up for that and get ourselves more completely expressed, and hence... that would just automatically, as a consequence of that, there'll be a more definitive differentiation between male and female. If we're still like some primitive reptile or something that has, okay. But of course, at the same time, you know, you're the only reason for creating this full expression of the differential is to power the upward ascent. You know, it's not an end in itself. Okay, now, the biggie is that sentence that has the italicized word in it. I mean, does it strike you as odd at all? Why is transmissible italicized? It's like, I mean, couldn't they just said personality and mind-spirit relationships are transmissible? Why did they have to say personality and mind-spirit relationships are transmissible? Okay, why did they do that? Why do they have these flashing arrows pointing at this thing? What the heck? Hint, 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 hint. Hint, 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 hint. Okay, why are they doing that? Okay, you have a search engine now. You can easily search for the occurrence of the word transmissible in the book. Remember, I've pointed this out before. Sometimes when they italicize a word, the point is not to emphasize the word in the context of the sentence or even in the context of the paragraph or even in the context of the section or the paper. Sometimes it's to hold that word up relative to all of the words in the book. You know, in the book. Look for that word in the rest of the book. What do you find? Okay. The word transmissible occurs 5 times in the book. Okay. So it's pretty easy to look at each time and see if there's anything there. You know, you're trying to figure out why they italicize this. You know, you know that's a possibility. Maybe they're trying to get you to connect it to another paragraph somewhere in the book. So you should check. It may not be the case, but it is, of course, in this instance. That's why I'm talking about it. Because it's just not, you know, you're looking, it's like, well, I don't need that italicized to understand this sentence or this paragraph. So you look and they, okay, and they, one time they mentioned transmissible when they're talking about creatorship is transmissible, at least to the point of a creator son, that's not transmissible past that. It's like, no, that doesn't seem to have anything to do with this sentence. One time they used transmissible. We read it not that long ago. They used transmissible when they were talking about the super absolute, you know, the trans absolute nature in the third source and center, and how that's transmissible to, you know, the offspring of the third source and center, like master physical controllers having anti-gravity, you know, presence and that stuff. Think that's what, you know, doesn't seem to be tied to this. One time they use transmissible when they're talking about reflectivity. You know, that you have kind of source beings related to the reflectivity mechanism, and, you know, and that's transmissible. You know, a reflective mother spirit can give rise to a Sakonafim that has reflective abilities. See, that's reflectivity is transmissible. Well, I don't know, maybe. I'm not really seeing how this ties to reflectivity. The other time. See, so that's 3, here's 4. There's only one other time it occurs. Okay. If you turn to paper 36, second section on page 397, one of the most curious, mysterious statements in the book has the word transmissible in it. Okay, so in section 2 there, the life carrier worlds, you know, they start going through the 7 worlds. And you got that block there about world number 1. You know, it's that great big famous paragraph that has the 48 units of pattern control and all that at the end of the paragraph there. Right in the middle of that paragraph, yeah, that whole paragraph is about the patterns of life. Okay, what are we reading about here? pattern of infinity, the pattern universe. Oh, these two transmissibles may very well be connected. What does it say? In the middle of that paragraph, it says, there were originally 12 distinct and divine concepts of transmissible life. Ah, one of the most mysterious little bits of numerology in the book. Where does 12 come from? Why does life have 12, a 12-fold pattern imposed upon it? It has a 3 and a 7 and a 12, it says, imposed upon it. I know the 3 and I know the 7. 12. What on earth is the source of the 12-fold pattern that's imposed upon life? Like it's saying here. Okay? Now, this is, it's very advanced. We're not going to, I'm not going to actually literally answer that question, but if you notice this, that the word transmissible here is italicized in paper 11. They're trying to get you to notice that it's used in that sentence right there. In other words, something that you would call mind-spirit relationships. You know, notice it says, okay, personality and mind-spirit relationships are transmissible. Okay, personality, I know what that's talking about. Mind-spirit relationships. What are mind-spirit relationships? Okay, it doesn't say the relationship between mind and spirit, or mind to spirit, or spirit to mind. It doesn't even say spirit-mind relationships. It says mind-spirit relationships. If I can find some place in the universe that's a source of pattern that literally has a fact involved in it that is properly described as mind-spirit, not spirit-mind, but mind-spirit, and if I discover that there's relationships in that mind-spiritness, I bet there'll be 12 relationships. And that's the source of the 12-fold pattern. Well, that's exactly what you figure out. Once you unpack the central universe, you discover it's a mind-spirit domain, and there's 12 mind-spirit relationships amongst the facets of deity there. The pattern universe, of course, has to be the source of any pattern for life. The threefold pattern, the sevenfold pattern, and the 12-fold pattern have to be in there. It's the pattern universe. All the patterns are in there.
Didn't they say originally?
Right. Of course, there's evolution. But see, it's the originating. Okay. So, yeah. I mean, that's... So without going into the details, but just to highlight that mode of construction of the revelation. This is the kind of stuff that they do. Okay. They don't want you to bury this book in a hole and wait for the master to return.
Or even a magisterial son.
Or even a magisterial son or Machiavelli, Melchizedek, or anyone else. They want you to put this book to use. They want you to grab a hold of it and start unpacking it. Invest it. Take your 5 or your 10 bags. And I want to see a heck of a lot more than 5 or 10 when I come back, says the master.
Some interest?
Yeah. I want to see some interest on what I've invested in you. Okay? Okay? I want to see lots of deductive use of this revelation. I want you to put it to use. I want you to start unpacking it. I want you to figure out why I italicized this. I didn't. There's no paragraph in the book where I tell you what I'd like you to figure out, because I'm not allowed to, but I can lead you right up to the door. And if you will take a hold of it and take it to the rest of the way, you will have something that you'll find very useful. Okay? But you need to do that. I'm not going to do that for you. Okay, so you have to have the courage to follow the clues and unpack the revelation. And you do things like that, you unpack the central universe, you take all the clues in the book, you put them all together, you unpack it, and you get another huge subset of mysteries in the book that are not mysteries anymore. They're living sentences now. They're not mysterious sentences where it's like, I don't know what that sentence means. Well, I guess I could have a mystical relationship to it. I could read it and go, oh, that is so mysterious. That doesn't help my life much. I've got to get that sentence to come alive. I have to find the truth of the sentence. There's no truth in mysticism. There's just fuzzy feelings in mysticism. And those will actually bring problems into your life, not help into your life. You know, mysticism. Okay? You need to get the book to be truth, living truth that you can obey. You got to unpack it. And the only way to do it is to have the courage to not bury it in the ground and wait for the master to return. You've got to start unpacking it. Okay? It takes a lot of work. And it not only takes a lot of work, it takes courage. I mean, it's courageous and independent cosmic thinking. You have to have the courage to use the book. Don't be afraid. They want you to use it. It's like, well, I don't know. If it doesn't exactly say it, I don't think I should think such things. Yeah. All right. So, transmissible. It's a transmissible. Okay. Find where it is in the book. Okay. Figure out what a mind-spirit relationship is. Notice the clues we gave you in the context here. They're talking about there's a pattern universe. You're looking for an explanation of a 12-fold pattern. You might want to look in the pattern universe. Okay, I mean, it's all right there.
On this page 397 that you directed us to, I'm concerned about the use of past tense. There were 12 distinct.
Right, remember... What's the relationship of Havona to to the seven super universes? It does two things. It's an initiating pattern and a destiny pattern. So there's some clues there. Is the sevenfoldness of the seven super universes going to go away? No, that's obviously a destiny pattern. It's there at the beginning, and it's going to be there at the end. Some things, though, must be more of an initiating pattern to get things off to the right start, and then you need to let it work out. So that's a clue. There's a difference between the sevenfold pattern and the 12-fold pattern. That's another thing that, if you think you've figured out what the sevenfold and the 12-fold pattern are, and it isn't immediately obvious why one would be more enduring than the other, then you probably have misinterpreted. It has to be immediately understandable that they're, from their difference, why that sentence says originally and not eternally.
They're not.
Yeah. Were. Yeah. Right. So, just all those little things, your clues. They're very careful. Always notice those. They're the checks and balances on any rationalization that you come up with. Those precise words can refute your false rationalization if you don't ignore them.
Like they made some extras so that they could delete if they had to.
Yeah, most likely it's going to go, it's going to start at 12 and go from there. Okay, I mean, just think about it simply. You start with 3, 7, and 12 in some sort of an eternal state where they're definitively separate. And then you throw the 3 together. Now you've got all kinds of relationships. The individual 12, each of the 12 can relate to each of the 7 and each of the 3. And there's a gazillion different ones that can come out. See, that's why. So you got to figure out where is it more fluid and where is it more solid in terms of, Okay. All right, let's read the rest of it here.
God's presence is central and eternal, glorious and ideal, His home is the beauteous pattern for all universe headquarters worlds. In the central universe of his immediate indwelling is the pattern for all universes in their ideals, organization, and ultimate destiny. Paradise is the universal headquarters of all personality activities and the source center of all force space and energy manifestations. Everything which has been, now is, or is yet to be, has come, now comes, or will come forth from this central abiding place of the eternal gods. Paradise is the center of all creation, the source of all energies, and the place of primal origin of all personalities.
Okay. Notice they're picking up some of the stuff they did already in this. In the midst of some kind of technical stuff that we spent a lot of time talking about, notice how much kind of poetic language they're throwing in here too, because they're wrapping up this paper and they're wanting to really get you to feel some spiritual drawing power so that you don't, this doesn't just slip through your fingers. You go, it's like, you remember the spiritual power that you felt in the midst of talking about transmissible and 12-fold patterns, and you keep them together. You know, so they're definitely doing that. But let's notice one of the little points again. We have that source center, that hyphenated term that we've started to notice is a very precise thing. It's not a center source, it's a source center. You know, if you turn the hyphen into a word, if you said the hyphen, it would be a source and center. You know, the Isle of Paradise is the paradise, source, and center in that order. Not center and source, but source and center. You know, if they mean center source and they want to say it all out, they'll say center and source. They'll write it in that order. You know, they're not interchangeable. Those are two different things. A center and source is different from a source and center. It's like, well, that's too complicated. I don't want it to be. Well, then you're going to miss all that stuff that's related to that in the book because it is different. A center source is not a source center. And the Isle is not a center source. It's not a source first and a center second. It's a center first and a source second. Yeah. The root of the fact is a center. It's like they're just, you know, saying in the poetry. You know, it's this, paradise is the center of all creation. That's the first thing they say. And then they say the source of all energies. So did they say the paradise is the source of all energies and the center of all creation? No, they didn't say it in that order. Center first, source second. They literally say it that way because they want you to understand it that way. Before it's a, you understand it as a source of anything like the source of space, say, before that thought has to be that it's the center of everything. It's the center of infinity before it's anything else. And then it's some measure of sourceness. It's the source of some things, not everything. And it's not the first source. But it definitely is a source.
Yeah. So when the book calls what we term the Universal Father as the first source and center, is the book lean, you know, the Revelators leaning towards that aspect of the Father that's more impersonal?
No, that description is in the sense of you have the seven absolutes, and six of them are literally just directly absolutes, but one of them is more the absolute of absolutes. It's the first source and center. I mean, now again, remember why they talk about, you know, why don't they say, for instance, there's a first source and center, and then there's a 2A and a 2B source and center, and then there's a third source and center. You know, why do they call first, second, third, and then paradise, source, and center? Okay. Why do they, you know, not sort of give the Isle and the Eternal Sun quite equal billing there? Again, what's your evolutional on-ramp to the understanding? If you have any interest in reading this book, it's probably not because you're an atheistic physicist. Okay? It's probably because you're a religionist and you've got some vague God notion. Okay? And the first thing that you need to find in the book, you know, is an on-ramp is, okay, well, I know about God, and I have no problem with you calling the monotheistic God the first source and center of all things and beings. Okay, good. Okay, we've got a starting point. Now, I'm just going to add one little thing to that. Okay, that infinite person that you feel you know already, there's two more persons that are kind of like that first person. And since that's your starting point, that what I'm going to call the first person, I'm not going to challenge you too much. Let's call those other ones the second person and the third person. Okay, all right, maybe I can go along with you there. That doesn't feel too threatening to my understanding of my relationship to God. And so the book goes. On and on and on it goes. Until finally you get to paper 105. Okay? And then they say, well, you know, after this many papers and this much working on getting a bigger thought in your head than Yahweh, we're going to use an expression. We're going to use an expression, paradise, source, and center. And we're pretty sure that you won't feel uncomfortable now, that you're ready to hear the Isle spoken of that way. Before that, we'll just let the Isle be, you know, that place where God stands. And it's pretty unthreatening. It's just this place where God stands. Okay, but when you're ready, we're going to, it's like, no, actually, the Isle is a lot more than just a ball of dirt, okay? It's just as cool as this thing that we called the second source and center. Okay. And so when all is said and done, is, oh, okay, so I'm not going to think so simplistically about first, second, and third. I mean, those are just labels that remind me that there's three persons, and the Isle is not a person. But it's just as purposed. You know, it's not, it's just as extensive in its influence as the Eternal Sun. In no sense can I say the Isle is small, but the Eternal Sun is big. They're equally big. They both have within them the ability to be that center for an infinite amount of spirit substance or an infinite amount of material substance. And see, so when all is said and done, you have four names that are sources and centers. And then there's little adjectives that kind of help you remember. Oh, yeah, and I kind of learned about them in an evolutional, experiential way. I started with one, and then I went to two, and then I went to three, and then I went to the paradise. Okay. There was a question somewhere. Where was it?
Well, no, okay. I think it would be okay. A good example now.
I mean, there's, you know, don't ever stop trying to come up with analogies. It's important to find an analogy for everything, a way of directly visualizing, conceptualizing all the things in here that really speaks to you and allows you to go, oh, okay, now I understand what they're trying to tell me there. Now that I arrange it in that picture and can see the relationships that way, now I understand them. And if you can find some way of picturing it, an analogy that you can really grab a hold of solidly, then from that foundation you can move to say an analogy that Chris told you one time 3 years ago, It's like, oh, okay, now I know what Chris meant by that analogy. I was really confused when he said it. It didn't click with me. But now that I have a foothold in infinity, I can take what I have and I can see if I just rotate it like that, then I have the picture he painted. And then I can rotate it this way and I have the picture that he painted and that she painted. And you begin, okay, and then think about the power of that. If you can start to objectively translate from one person's picture to another, think of how much more potential you have to have a real relationship with that person. You genuinely understand the center point of their initial consciousness. You can do what Jesus did all the time. He knew what the perspective was that that person had. He could rotate his picture to that perspective, see exactly what they're seeing, and help them to understand what they're seeing, and then help them to rotate it. Okay? If I don't directly understand how you see things, I'll either just give up on you, and try to find a place I can live on the planet where I don't have to ever see you and relate to you, or I will decide that you're an abomination and demonize you. Obviously, that's a demonic perspective. You know, that's the false perspective because it's not mine. And my perspective is innately divine, and it's the only true perspective. And anything that's different is fundamentally flawed, you know, et cetera. I mean, this is what, you know, this is the normal process. People take their initial perspective, their initial worldview, they absolutize it with the absolute dimension of their personality. And the moment you do that, the moment you think that your relativity is absolute, then everyone else's relativity is no longer positive, it's negative. And there's no hope for the brotherhood of man. The only way you can get the brotherhood of man is I have to be able to start it, say. Let it begin with me. Let me go up, get an objective perspective on myself, and then I can move across to someone else and go down to where they are and then help them up. Now there's two of us up here, and we can go over here, and together we can go down and we can lift you up. Now there's three of us up here. Before long, we might actually have the brotherhood of man. We might actually have kindred minds. Okay? Right now, we just have a potential. We're kindred spirits. You have the potential to be lifted up, but you haven't been lifted up yet. Jesus said, I find you here with the potential to be lifted up, but I would lift you up. You're not self-lifting, no matter how much how delusional you know, your worldview is. You're not automatically up. You can't lift yourself up. You need to be lifted up. And you don't have to actually wait for the relationship between your hard knock experiences and God's still small voice to get you, to wake up and have him pull you up. I actually can help you. If I've gotten myself up, I can help you up. That's what a true parent does to a child. It's the difference between a parent and a child. If it's a true relationship, the parent is up and the child is not yet up, but the child can be lifted up, okay? Because personality is transmissible. You know, I've transmitted liftable up ability, okay, to that child. I can go over it. But now if I'm not up, if I'm down there with the child, then we both live a life of down. Okay? Okay. So, again, just notice how, it's like, wait a minute. We just got on this whole discussion. What does that have to do with the aisle? See, notice how, you know, when you start to have a true picture, things naturally have this living quality, where no matter what we're talking about, immediately speaks to my life, and a living life, a life where I'm actually of some use to God. I can be an agent that fosters the manifestation of spiritual gravity in another. I can help them with that up thing. You know, let me show you how to go up. You know, if you don't like down, would you like up? It's like, well, what's that? Let me show you. What did, you know, were there initially 12 apostles?
Six.
Right, and what did the six go out and say to the other six?
Come and see what we see.
Yeah. Okay. Jesus didn't go out and do it. It doesn't take a creator being to go out and do that. A lowly fisherman can go out and do that 2,000 years ago. Let me show you what I've found. Okay? Let me show you up.
Jesus was always that parent figure. Yeah. Does that make sense to you? So he was saying, oh, Jerusalem, if you would have mm-hmm. and I would have protected you like right. a hen does
right.
a chick.
Right.
And so,
right.
am I on the right course?
Right again. Notice it, where you take what I was just saying. I can't force you to go up. Even if I'm a creator son incarnate, I can't force the Sanhedrin to look up. There's none so blind as those who will not see. If they will not lift their head up, all you can do is... say it's sad to record that on this day you all died. You know, I mean, that's what Jesus did, right? You know, he bemoaned. It's like, why? Why would you do that? Why would you choose that? When you reject me, you reject the Father. And now it's over. And now it's done for you. The end is upon you. I'm saddened. All right, let's just stop there. Let's just stop there, because you can go on forever, obviously. But you have to have the strength to deal with those who will not accept your help. And it takes a lot of strength, because what they need to do is so easy, but they will not do it, and it's painful. You know, to see someone that you love impose such emptiness upon themselves, when it would be so easy for their life to be filled with joy. Why do you choose to be bitter and angry and empty? You don't have to. It's so easy to not be. Just open the door and let God in.
You know the answer to that why, don't you? Pride.
Yeah. Right. And we all know pride goeth before the fall. But right. But it doesn't make it any easier, you know, when it's someone that you feel a lot for, to see them make that sad choice. All right.
After all, to mortals, the most important thing about eternal paradise is the fact that this perfect abode of the universal Father is the real and far distant destiny of the immortal souls of the mortal and material sons of God, the ascending creatures of the evolutionary worlds of time and space. Every God-knowing mortal who has espoused the career of doing the Father's will has already embarked upon the long, long paradise trail of divinity pursuit and perfection attainment. And when such an animal origin being does stand, as countless numbers now do, before the gods on paradise, having ascended from the lowly spheres of space, such an achievement represents the reality of a spiritual transformation bordering on the limits of supremacy. Presented by Perfector of Wisdom, commissioned thus to function by the Ancients of Days and your versa.
Okay, besides that, bringing it home in the poetry of that last paragraph, there's that last little statement has an important little technical point in it that, if you notice, will alleviate a lot of confusion when you go forward and start reading about you and, you know, your ascension career and all this stuff that follows this paper going forward into the book. To notice what they tell you up front here. So I'm starting here. I do what they're describing here. I climb my way up. I get all the way up to the Isle of Paradise. Okay. Now I know, there's that other spot in the book when I get way up to paper 112. Not the right paper, I think that's, the personality survival paper. I think that's 112, isn't it? they tell me in there that my career in the grand universe has two phases to it, first phase and a second phase. The first phase is here to paradise. Second phase is after I leave paradise, is go out and start working as a finaliter. Okay, there's a potential for a lot of misunderstanding about those two phases if you don't carefully notice what they said here. Okay, so I get up to there, and it represents the reality of a spiritual transformation bordering on the limits of supremacy. Okay, the fullness of supremacy is the top of the whole finite process. So in the first leg of my career, first half, I basically get all the way up to the top. Okay, the second phase isn't more of the same. Okay. This is true of sun-fused mortals and spirit-fused mortals too. We don't need to go into the details, but let's just talk about us in this. So that first half, is more vertical than horizontal. The ascension leg. That's why you call it the ascension. Okay. It's there's some horizontal, but it's predominantly vertical. Basically, essentially all the way up to the top. The second half has a little bit of vertical. You're not, it's bordering on the limits of supremacy. You got a little bit to go yet. So there's a little bit of vertical, but the second half is more horizontal. So first, there's ascension vertically, and then there's horizontal penetration to fill out your relationship with the whole that you're in. You're in a certain universe. Okay, a spirit-fused mortal is in a local universe. So their horizontal thing, they've got to flesh out their relationship with the limits of a local universe. Come into relationship with the whole, not just with one line up through it. Getting to Salvington. Okay. They have to penetrate the whole local universe. A sun-fused mortal has to penetrate the whole super universe in the second half of their career. After they did the beeline up, got to the top, and they go horizontally and flesh out their relationship with the whole. Okay, so you make a beeline to the top, and you've got to flesh out a relationship to a whole. What whole? Okay. The title of the next paper is The Universe of Universes. Okay. Okay, you have to, as a finaliter, you're in a womb. Spirit-fused mortals are in this womb, the created mother spirit. Sun-fused mortals are in this womb, the reflective mother spirits. If you're a notch up, you're in this womb. No, that's two notches up. Okay, you're in the womb of the creative mother's agencies of the Ancients of Days. You're at the collective super universe level. You're going, are you going out to just one super universe to find out? Or no?
All seven.
You go to all seven. Okay. Now you're not at the next higher one, the grand. Okay. This is the grand universe level. How do the revelators refer to the domain that you're penetrating, that you're fleshing out your horizontal relationship with? You know, it's going to be a universe, it's going to be a whole, but it's that whole that's the collection of all the local universes. A universe of local universes, the collection of all the local universes. You know, as we go into the next paper, we'll see them pointing this out right away. Fundamentally, the super universe level is a collection of local universes. The primary creative elements, units, are not super universes. They're local universes. Okay? It's a universe of local universes. So in the present universe age, and we don't have universes out in the first outer space level, so, you know, in the present universe age, the universe of universes is the super universe, you know, ends at the margins of the super universe level. Okay? That collection of universes is literally a collection of local universes. That's the universe of universes. That's the domain of your post-paradise finaliter career. You have, and there, that's a whole. It's not, it's, you know, the title of the paper is not the universes. It's the universe of universe. There's some wholeness to that collection. That means there's a mother presence that's below the universal mother, that's below the grand universe level, but above the super universe level, the individual super universe level. Okay? There's a womb that you're in. You have to be minded by someone. You don't have supreme mind as a finaliter. You're not minded directly, you know, by supreme mind. Okay? You have to be in a mindal womb above the local universe level, but below the supreme mind. The womb of supreme mind.
And above the master spirit level, too.
Right. I mean, above the individuality of the master spirits, yes. You transcended the individuality of the master spirit.
Yeah.
I mean, where did you transcend the individuality of your master spirit? You know, when will you transcend the individuality of the seventh master spirit?
When we leave the Orvantan to go to Avon.
No, not quite yet. It's when you go from the seventh to the sixth circuit of Avona. That's when you graduate. Remember, you're a four-stage spirit, a graduate spirit. When you get out of the womb of spiritual womb of the master spirit, and you transcend that individuality.
That's so reassuring to me, because I seem to remember somewhere in saying that your destiny and the core of the finality was in the outer space, in the universes on the outer space levels.
Yeah, after the second leg of your career, it is. But you know. Yeah, it'll be a long time before any of us are going out to the outer space levels. But the first thing you've got to do is, you know, you've got a whole lot of, I mean, you need, you know, who are you seeking, you know, as a finaliter? Remember, creatures are always seeking.
Seeking the Supreme.
Yeah, God the Supreme. In order to find God the Supreme, what's the size of the footprint of God the Supreme? The whole universe of universes right now. So you've got to get in a relationship with that whole ball of wax, or there's no way you're going to find God the Supreme. Can't find it in some part. You got to find it in the whole. So, yeah. So I just wanted to, I mean, obviously, if we'd gone into the next papers, you can see how they provide a transition, see, with that last sentence into the next paper.
Yeah.
Okay. So just noticing that, you know, it's something that a lot of readers miss, that first leg gets you basically up to the limits of supremacy. So don't just think of it as more ascension. No, it's a totally different ball of wax. It's not the ascension career as a finality. That's why so much of what you do in that second half is not in here. because they weren't allowed to reveal stuff beyond the ascension career. So, for instance, the mother whose womb you're in that second half of the career, they have to mention it because logically you recognize you got to be in some womb. And once you finally get the womb thing figured out. So they have to mention who those mothers are. But they can't really reveal any details. So they're called the unrevealed creative mother agencies of the Ancients of Days. Because they aren't about the ascension career, so they are technically unrevealed. Okay, but they're not unmentioned because they have to mention them or the picture would be incomplete. I mean, I would have already transcended the revelation, you know, and I figured out a long time ago that there had to be, you know, another group of mothers, okay, just logically. Okay, so let's just take a moment here. And reflect on this and think about how we're going to go out. You know, we're actually going to presage, see, that second half of our career when we start reading the next paper. We're going to start penetrating the universe of universes and really kind of getting ourselves ready for that day way in the future when we're going to do that. We're going to go out, and this is not going to be abstract. We're going to really get our hands on all the details of the whole super universe level.